Hi, Chad Biffley here from Toontown Records in Flaphappenville, New Jersey, Maine. And have we got a great record for you. You've seen them in the movies. You've pinned posters of them up in your dungeon. And you've probably dreamed about hearing them talk their way through some of your most favoritist tunes of the most popularistist catalogs of the musical artists of the 20th century. Well, now, wait no longer. For Toontown Records presents Christopher Walken.
Monday, you can hold your head. Tuesday, Wednesday, stay in bed. Thursday, watch the walls instead. It's Friday, I'm in love. Saturday, bubble wait. And Sunday, always comes too late. But Friday never hesitates. Dressed up to the eyes, it's a wonderful surprise to see your shoes and your spirits rise. Throwing out your frown and just smiling at the sound. A sleek and a chic spinning round and around. Always take a big bite. It's such a gorgeous sight to see you eat in the middle of the night. You can never, ever get enough, enough of this stuff. It's Friday and I'm in love.
And it's Bond, James Bond, as you've never heard him before. Shaken and stirred. It's none other than Sir Roger Moore. And some days it don't come easy. And some days it don't come hard. Some days I don't come at all. And these are the days that never end. And some nights you're breathing fire. And some nights you're carved in ice. Some nights you're like nothing I've ever seen before or will again. And maybe it's crazy. Oh, it's crazy. And it's true. I know you can save me. No one else can save me now but you. As long as the planets are turning. As long as the stars are burning. As long as your dreams are coming true. You better believe it, that I would do anything for love. Oh, I would do anything for love. Oh, I would do anything for love, my dear, but I won't do that. No, not even James Spader would do that. And you know him from the Batman movies as Alfred because you haven't seen any movies before the year 2001. It's Michael Caine.
I've been in love and lost my senses. Spinning through the town. Sooner or later, the fever ends. And I wind up feeling dead. I need a woman who'll take charge on a love that burns hot enough to last. So when the night falls, my lonely heart calls. Oh, I want to dance with somebody. I want to feel the heat with somebody. Yeah, I want to dance with somebody. With somebody who loves me. Oh, I want to dance with somebody, Master Wade. I want to feel the heat. Yeah, I want to dance with somebody who loves me.
All this and more is yours for the reasonable price of $29.99. But that's not all. Act now and we'll throw in this free album of bonus tracks that includes Brian Blessed's haunting rendition of Elton John's Your Song.
And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but know that it's done. I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words how wonderful life is. Now you're in the world.
And also, this wonderful theme song from an after-movie diner.
Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of the After Movie Diner. A most excellent episode, one might say. Let's hope it doesn't get too bogus or anything like that. To join me on yet again looking at some fantastically nostalgic time travel movies from us 30-somethings youth is the gentleman also known as the Nerd Lunch, although unfortunately one of their members could not be with us, and we're going to lay into him in a minute. But it is my undecided thrill and pleasure to welcome back the most bodacious Carl and Trammell, or CT, and the ever excellent Paxton Holly back onto the After Movie Diner. Gentlemen, good evening.
Thank you, John.
Good evening, John. You know, we almost didn't do it, but we saw future versions of ourselves who talked us into coming onto the show.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad Rufus is out there making sure the diner continues.
Yes.
Because I have this theme of the future that it's just the White House has been turned into one big diner, and it's just like giving out free burgers, and I'm on the decks at the back recording shows every night. And yeah. I don't think that's going to happen, but who knows? Who knows? Bill and Ted didn't think Wild Stallions was going to go anywhere, but it did, which is most excellent and fantastic. I'm going to stop saying
yeah.
No, actually, mine, because I'm English, would probably be more like ding, ding, a ding, ding, a ding, a ding. It would be more
like Bill's dad when he was possessed.
Right, yes, it would be more like a. Well, his is more sort of George Benson jazz guitar, but yeah. Mine would probably be a lute or something. It would probably be very medieval and. Ding, ding, a ding, ring, a ding, a ding. It would be all like green sleeves or something, right? We're going to be talking about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. So, let me ask you guys, CT first, I guess. Why the idea for you guys to be my resident time travel movie experts?
Well, we all love time travel. We talked about time travel on our show a couple of times, and. It's just such a fun way of telling stories, and there's so many different ways of going about it. There's so many different rules where, you know, in this kind of movie, these are the rules, and this kind of movie, it's done differently, and you can go to the past, you can go to the future. Alternate realities is just so much opportunity, and I also love the way that you can affect so many different genres. You know, you can have something like Bill and Ted's that's very fun and comical and lighthearted. We talked about Back to the Future last time. That certainly runs a lot more into the fun, but still adventure action kind of thing. And
sure,
you can have romance movies. I mean, there's been a couple of these recently, like About Time and Time Traveler's Wife. And so you can really run the gamut with time travel. And so I love the opportunity to talk to you about this genre, because it's just one of my favorites.
Nice.
And like the kids say, time travel is kind of my jam, right? So, so ever since Back to the Future,
when I've been did kids say that, Pax? Exactly.
Kids, but my understanding
they will
is that they are sure. Currently saying it right now. Is my understanding
right?
And but it's ever since Back to the Future in '85, which we talked about last time. I've been kind of fascinated with time travel genre, and I read books and I watch the movies, and I just kind of follow it along. And I have a feature on my blog called Time Travel Logs, where I review time travel kind of stuff. So
nice.
I'm just a big fan of the genre, and I watch as much of it as I can. And it's like CT said, it's just a lot of fun. Just a lot of fun to watch that kind of stuff and see how different things make the rules different, and how they make it work differently.
Yeah, because although they're obviously very different movies, in fact, just Excellent Adventure and Bogus Journey are sort of two completely different movies as well. But Bill and Ted, the two movies, are very different from the Back to the Future films, yet they both feel... They both have a similar kind of MO in terms of just unabashed entertainment. They have that kind of 80s look to them. Do you know what I mean? They just have that kind of 80s polished Spielbergian kind of look to them, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess if we're going to continue with a sort of 80s, early 90s theme for the next show, we should probably cover that great Emilio Estevez classic Free Jack.
I would be all up for that. I love that movie.
I haven't seen, I honestly haven't seen that movie. We were talking just before we started about sort of mom and pop video rental shops. I have not seen Free Jack since I rented it from a shop ages ago. And all I remember it as being completely and utterly bonkers. It's also one of those movies that kind of has never been sort of resurrected particularly by the internet as a cult movie. So I can only assume it's either the greatest lost classic or just a completely dire piece of confusing crap.
You're right. It doesn't have any following either way. It like usually like something like that, like say another thing I like called The Shadow.
Sure.
Usually comes up with something like everyone hates it. And it's like, this is understood to be a terrible movie, but Free Jack hasn't fallen either way. It's like, people don't hate it. People don't love it. And it's like, you never hear anything about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny, whenever I kind of think about delving into sort of the Brat Pack films or the films featuring Brat Pack actors and so on. Obviously, there's kind of the like 5 or 10 main ones that people go to, normally hovering around John Hughes. But there was a ton of movies made in sort of the 80s and the early 90s, actually off the back of those particular actors and that particular cast, the people who were particularly big at that time, that really just kind of, a lot of them sort of fell by the wayside in sort of big ways. You know, I remember my sister enthusiastically watching the Kiefer Sutherland, Robert Downey Jr. starring 1969, and then never hearing about that movie ever again. You know, so there are some of those films out there, and I feel like Free Jack is probably, in terms of the internet and cultdom, probably needs a resurrection. So I think we should definitely try and track that down for next time, and I'll try and find another one to pair it up with that's hopefully in a similar kind of bonkers 80s vein.
I just looked it up, John, on fanfiction.net. Free Jack has a total of 1 fan fiction story submitted for it.
That's so beautiful that there's one person out there.
It is me. It is mine.
But I think that's great. I love that Free Jack occupies, or rather, occupies a fairly unoccupied corner of the internet, I want to say. Because it's one of those movies that, I don't remember at all, other than he's a race car driver, there's an explosion, Mick Jagger is in it. I remember certain things about it. But
Anthony Hopkins is in it. It's amazing. Yeah,
it's one of those movies that I feel should have a resurrection. So we're going to do that, guys, and soon. So when we next have you on the show, hopefully before the end of the year, I'll try and find another sort of equally bonkers time travel movie. There's also, I wouldn't suggest pairing it with this, but the other one that springs to mind, and I can't remember the name of it, but the Christopher Reeve, you were talking about rom-coms earlier, but isn't
Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time.
Where he travels about the play. I mean, it's very sort of soppy and not our kind of movies at all, but that's another one that kind of springs to my mind from sort of, was that late 80s, early 90s, something like that?
I think it was early 80s, right?
I think like 82, 83.
So was it after he did the first 2 Supermen and he just thought, oh, I need a break kind of thing?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's my recollection.
Nice, okay,
Jane
cool.
Seymour is the female lead in that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got a feeling. Yeah. Seymour fits the bill for kind of costume drama, soppy romantic escapades. That probably that sounds about right to me.
Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour. I'm on board if you guys want to do that.
I had an ex who was enthused about that movie, and I watched about 20 minutes of it, I think, once when I was on my on a sick bed, and she was like, "Oh, I'm going to put this movie on, and it's great. You'll really like it. Like, this will make you feel better." And, you know, 20 minutes into it, I think I was asleep. But I was ill at the time, so who knows. But we can check that out. I'm just trying to think of others that I know off the top of my head. I'm sure we'll be able to find some more. I'll do some research before next time. So, guys, why don't you tell us, before we crack on into Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, why don't you tell us what's going on over at the Nerd Lunch at the moment?
Well, we just had a big episode where we teamed up with another podcast. You know, as we've mentioned before, I think, on the show, we do cover the nerd stuff. So we'll talk about science fiction, movies, retro stuff, comics, all that stuff. We also cover the lunch stuff. So we'll do episodes entirely about fast food, junk food. And we had the cast members, the entire cast of the Nosh show on our episode for episode 137. And so there were 7 people on the show, and we did a fast food draft, and that's proven to be our most popular episode ever, actually. That's been a pretty big deal for us. Check that out. We also were on the NOS show, so it's sort of like getting two episodes for the price of one in 1 week. And, you know, all the usual stuff on either side of that. We've got an episode coming out where we discuss the first Star Trek movie. And Pax and I are still friends after that discussion. So,
are we talking about Star Trek, the motion picture? Or are we talking
Star
about
Trek, the motion picture?
Josh Abrams. Okay.
Yes.
I just heard the greatest. Someone called J.J. Abrams the other day Jar Jar Abrams, and I'm going to steal that. So I'm enjoying that. I wondered if you meant that terrible abortion of a film, but I'm glad. Yeah, the original Star Trek, the motion picture. That's an interesting film. I like the fact that it's meant to be in the future, but DeForest Kelly walks around in that movie looking something like a BG from 1978. It's quite fantastic.
It was amazing.
Yeah, the big beard and the medallion. I'm like, seriously, guys, you think this is going to fly in like 10 years, let alone 200 years or whatever that's meant to be into the future. So.
Everything goes in cycles, though. That's sort of how I write that up.
It's all, yeah. Right.
No, it'll be.
So the 70s are going to go in like 200 or 300 cycles before it then comes back around. Exactly. And DeForest is thinking, I think I'm going to have some of that open collar medallion beard action. It's fantastic. Also, the other mad thing about Star Trek: The Motion Picture is they put Kirk up against a woman he can't reproduce with, which just doesn't make any fucking sense. Because he should be sleazing all over her, like the Lothario captain, you know, Boy Scout that he is. But unfortunately not. She's all, you know, hyper-intelligent and asexual.
Well, you can download episode 138 of our show, and you can hear all of our thoughts about Star Trek The Motion Picture. And find out who's a fan and who's not. Because there is at least one who is a fan, and the others aren't.
Okay, I mean, Wrath of Khan is still the best, so all agree on that. Yeah,
I think we do. I think we do all agree on that. Yeah.
So that sounds great. That sounds great, guys. So the NOS show being so popular, do you think therefore you might want to continue that pair up, or have you guys talked about maybe like moving the show more in that direction, or are you just happy that that one particular thing has been successful and you want to keep doing your thing and hopefully the success carries on and it wasn't just the subject matter?
I mean, we're going to continue doing our shows and it wouldn't be a thing we would merge regularly. Maybe it would happen again, and we've already talked about how we all had fun doing it. So there have been talks about it happening again even before the end of the year, but yeah, they would still do their show. We'd still do our show for now. So
nice.
I think in the end we'd bring them down rather than they'd help us out.
Yeah.
So, did you have anything else you guys wanted to, mention, talk about before we go into the movies?
Well, Pax and I both also do other podcasts. So if you don't mind, Pax,
no, please,
why don't you mention
right
your other show you do?
Monthly, I do a cult film club podcast where we talk about just culty films from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And our most recent episode, we did a 1986 movie called Rad about BMX biking. And it was a lot of fun.
Cool.
And it was popular enough that the star of that movie, Bill Allen, contacted us. And we got to interview him on our recent episode. So we talked to him for about an hour or so. And
wonderful.
I got an autographed book of his and stuff. So it was a lot of fun, and having a lot of fun with that. That's Cult Film Club. You can find us at cultfilmclub.com.
Nice.
Yeah, I do another show that's also monthly. It's called the Pod James Pod Podcast. And we just released our 10th episode this month. We release every month on the 007th of the month. So
very, very cunning. Nice.
See what I'm doing there? Yeah, see?
Yeah.
And it's me and a guy named Aaron Nix. And we have a third co-host named Alabama Dog. And just to be completely frank and honest, even though we say this is about James Bond, it really is just a disaster of a podcast. It's just crazy stuff. We never really stay on topic, and it's all purposeful. It's all because there's plenty. If you want to talk, if you listen to people talk about James Bond, there's about a million other podcasts. But if you want to listen to guys pick dodgeball teams with James Bond characters and talk about vending machine snack company foods and argue about whether or not the dog co-host is living up to his obligations, then this is the show for you.
And whether you actually watch the movie or you get your assistant to watch the movie.
that comes into play as well. So
that's fantastic. And are you doing each movie, you know, going through the pack? Or I mean, because otherwise you don't have 23 episodes or 24 maybe if the next one comes out before you finish.
We do them out of order. And we cover...
That's frustrating.
It doesn't really matter.
I understand. I'm joking. Yeah.
Our argument for doing them out of order is so that it allows them to stand on their own. So there's no like context. So you can watch a movie and we haven't got the baggage of the previous movies behind it. It kind of helps let a movie stand on its own if we watch it out of order. So
sure.
That's,
okay. I get it.
That's sort of the conceit, I guess, of that reasoning. And then... we'll cover other Bond projects as well. So we'll do eventually we'll do Never Say Never Again. We do have Casino Royale episode coming up that isn't the Craig one. We do have plans to do some other episodes that aren't the movies. So I don't know how long it'll
down
go.
Have you tracked down the American TV film where
that
he's
will come
played
up.
Jimmy Bond? Yeah. Excellent. Oh, well, that sounds great, guys. That sounds great. So I urge everyone listening to check those out. So let's move on to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I will probably stick the trailer for which here.
Bill, Ted, this is really quite simple. Unless you get an A+ on your final oral report tomorrow, I have no choice but to flunk the both of you.
Two epic airheads.
Who is Joan of Arc?
Noah's wife. We're in danger of flunking most heinously tomorrow, Ted.
One time-traveling telephone booth.
Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
I'm here to help you with your history report.
What?
That book will give you the number of any place you want to go.
Let's reach out and touch someone.
Who knew history?
Two beers, please.
Could be such an excellent adventure.
Who's here?
It's Billy the Kid.
Don't worry, I'll bring you back here as soon as you talk in our report.
Socrates philosophize with him. All we are is dust in the wind, dude.
We are in most excellent shape for our report.
Excuse me, do you know where there are any personages of historical significance around here?
How's it going, royal ugly dudes?
Put them in the Iron Maiden.
Excellent!
Execute them.
Bogus.
Keanu Reeves.
Those are historical babes.
Alex Winter.
It's a history report, not a babe report.
Napoleon.
Zinky Piggy.
Genghis Khan. Sigmund Freud.
How's it going, fruit dude?
Socrates. And Abraham Lincoln.
Audio, dude!
You guys are really us. What number are we thinking of?
69, dudes!
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Which was made in 1989. It's directed by Stephen Herrick, who is also known for such cinematic classics as The Mighty Ducks and Don't Tell Mum the Babysitter's Dead, as well as Critters. He then went on to make 101 Dalmatians, Holy Man, Rockstar, and then a bunch of films nobody cares about. But for a brief moment there, at the end of the 80s and the early 90s, every single one of his movies was a hit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good work on Mr. Herrick's part, I think. Unfortunately, he's recently made a bunch of things I've never heard of. Let's start first with you, Pax. How did you first come across Bill and Ted's? I mean, is this a movie you remember being released, or did you come to it later?
Yeah, I remember it being released. It was several years after Back to the Future. Obviously, the time travel hook got me. I wasn't in love with the trailer. I think through the trailer, I didn't really get the caricatures that Bill and Ted were. It just didn't come across for me, but I was like, I'll probably go see it. It looks fun. A time traveling phone booth. I mean, I thought that's kind of cool. And I think there was a quick shot of Billy the Kid in the trailer. So that, yeah, I went and saw it in the theater based off the trailer.
Yeah. The time traveling telephone booth. I presume that's because no one on this side of the Atlantic had seen Doctor Who yet.
Yeah.
Which of course uses the same conceit, but I mean in a totally different way. The TARDIS is obviously not, I mean this one the telephone booth is just a telephone booth. I mean, you use the numbers to punch in the coordinates of where you want to go in time. It's not the same necessarily as the TARDIS, but
no, but it has similar properties. Like, it's bigger inside, clearly, because at first it's just two people, and by the end of the movie you're fitting like 13 people in there.
Yes, no, there's a certain bit of artistic license, but I think that's the cartoony nature of both movies overall. There's a very sort of cartoony vibe come about, and it's interesting because, of course, this predates both Wayne's World and Beavis and Butthead, and of course, you know, Beavis and Butthead are essentially like the evil Bill and Ted, but as cartoons, you know, and it's interesting that would continue animation. So, CT, when did you first come across this movie, or do you remember it being released?
I do remember it being released. I would have been in like junior high when it was released. I didn't see it. I actually didn't see it until maybe in the last year for the first time. Yeah, for whatever reason, though, it did look like because of time travel and all that. Everything else about it didn't seem like something that I would really like. And so I think I finally broke down and watched it just to sort of fill that gap on my own. Not for any reason, like not for like watching it for the podcast or anything like that. About a year ago, and so I don't know. I think because I wasn't in 1989 anymore. I wasn't in middle school. I don't know if it really spoke to me the same way it would have to any of you who watched it originally.
Yeah, I mean, my history with this movie is I don't think I saw the first one in the cinema. I definitely saw Bogus Journey in the cinema. But 89, I seem to think that 89, I was aware of like TV stuff and Monty Python. I remember going to see Disney stuff and things in the cinema before 89. But when I was 8 or 9 years old, that's when I kind of remember really being aware there were things called movies and aware that they were being released. Do you know what I mean? There's just some idea behind there. This would have been a rental for me, but it would have been a kind of the moment it came out kind of rental for me. I definitely had the video and rented it several times and then purchased it. I can't say, funny enough, that it was ever a sort of passionate favorite of mine or that the characters were ever a passionate favorite of mine, but there was something... There was definitely something that I was drawn to about the movie. But saying that, although I have owned them and I owned them on DVD and various other things, I actually didn't revisit them as an adult, or certainly this first one. I'd revisited Bogus Journey a couple of times, but I don't think I'd revisited Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure as an adult until, you know, this last year. When I watched it, and then I've watched it again in lead up to this show, and so I have, yeah, I almost came to it afresh again, although I do remember it being one of those that we did watch quite frequently when it first came out. I can't say what I made of the characters in, you know, coming from England, I don't know that the characters had any resonance or any kind of, I just thought it was they were just kind of dopey, fun, idiotic, kind of cartoon, dumb American teenager kind of characters. I didn't really kind of put anything more on that as a kid watching it. But it certainly wasn't anything that there's no British equivalent of those kind of characters. There certainly wasn't in the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you even made the Doctor Who comparison, and these guys could be, no more. There's no way they could be anything like Doctor Who. That character. I mean, the only thing you look at this, and the only thing that's similar to Doctor Who is the fact that they're going into a box that's got a phone in it. There's nothing.
Sure. Yeah.
Nothing about it like Doctor Who.
No, and it's a very. I mean, the Excellent Adventure is a very interesting movie because I think that it's a film where it has a. It has clearly a ton of ideas in it. I just don't think any of those ideas are particularly seen through. I think that it kind of becomes a sketch film at a certain point.
Yeah.
Or becomes a kind of film of moments at a certain point. And I don't think Bill and Ted as characters, or even the odd appearance of the fantastic George Carlin as Rufus, tie the movie together as successfully as they would in the second one. I think once you've watched Bogus Journey, it's very hard to sort of then watch Excellent Adventure and think of it as highly. And although it was a much more successful movie and has the classic status, has a higher rating on IMDb, is one that people may prefer, for my palate, I'm a much bigger fan of the second movie. But there is a lot to be said for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure as well. I don't want to sell it short. So why don't we go with you, CT, and just a few of the scenes that stand out for you and some of the general things you like about the film to begin with.
Okay. It's hard to get into some of this without addressing Bogus Journey, because I think the one major thing that this movie lacks that Bogus Journey fixes is the fact that there's no overarching definite threat with a face.
Right.
With Excellent Adventure, there's a little bit of Ted's dad. There's somewhat of a challenge there. But I mean, by all accounts, like, Ted's dad is actually right. I mean, these guys are losers. Like, there's not like any like I hate Ted's dad. I mean, Ted's dad is especially in my 37-year-old eyes, like, right. Ted's dad's right.
Right. Exactly.
So the big threat, the big challenge, like, that there isn't that like enemy that they have to face off against and win and overcome this big challenge. It's like they have to prepare a report for school. And that's kind of what brings the movie down for me a little bit. But at the same time, I think it adds a little bit of charm, and that it is a very simple story. It is like, hey, they got a time machine, and how would two guys in high school use it? Well, hey, let's do our history report with it. And so I like the simplicity of it. I don't think it necessarily worked in their advantage. But like you said, John, it does turn into very sketch-based comedy. There's some stuff that works in that and stuff that doesn't. Like, I would say half of the mall sequence, there's some funny bits, and then half of it's like just weird slapstick stuff that is very clumsy.
Yeah, I mean, what's most interesting in terms of it versus Bogus Journey is, of course, the thing that would make Rufus even give a shit that they do their history report doesn't happen until the end of Bogus Journey, which is their big international broadcast, which, of course, means that the future will be run by people who are disciples of Bill and Ted. There's no real explanation other than, oh, in the future, you guys are a big deal kind of thing. There's no real explanation why Rufus would be doing any of this, in terms of that, if you hadn't seen the second film.
Exactly.
So that's another thing that lets it down. Now, on its pure setup, structure, and whatever, there are some nice things in it. But like you say, it also devolves into, like, why is there a sped up montage of them cleaning the apartment, like, or the house? Like, I didn't really understand that, other than it's amusing to see Sigmund Freud get a vacuum cleaner to the face. I mean, apart from that, I don't really understand.
I think you answered your own question. I mean, why right before that, when they come into the garden, I mean, they're introducing him, and he introduces him with names like Dave Beethoven and, right. and like silly names like that, because there's no reason for them to do that. But they do it because it's funny. I think a lot of this, a lot of what you guys said, because you guys didn't see it originally, and I did. And
I saw it. I would have seen it in 1990. Like, I would have seen it on VHS. Right.
Right. But I saw it before, and for me, Excellent Adventure is better. I enjoy Excellent Adventure, and I agree that it doesn't have the big bad like the second one, but I don't think it needs it. I think what it lives and dies on is the charisma and the characters of Bill and Ted, and yeah, it's mostly vignettes of them going to get the characters, but I mean, I think it works, and I think for the most part it works. And then I love the report at the end. I think that entire sequence of them doing the report at the end is great, and it's a great ending. And I think it, for me, it works completely, and that's why I enjoy it. Is it a little thin why Rufus wants them to do it? I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously Rufus and everyone there is fine, so clearly it gets done. Why does he need to go back in the first place? Because it's going to get done. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that was kind of thin anyway. But time travel movies like this, usually you can find something that's like, well, why they do that? I mean,
right?
And it's a little weird. And the one of the issues
I just mentioned that because of it standing alone is the reason why I mentioned that. Not so much as a time travel plot hole, but the fact talking about this movie as a standalone film is a little odd. That's all I meant by that, just because of Rufus.
Yeah, I mean, the movie's odd. I mean, it is kind of an odd movie, but that's why I like it. I mean, and one of the things I think that I don't have the issue with the big bad. I think my one issue is I think it's a dumb rule that the clock in San Dimas is always ticking. That doesn't make any sense, and it kind of negates the pro of having a time machine. That back in, like, wherever you travel in time, you have, when you go back, it has to be like, if you spent 3 hours traveling through time, it's 3 hours later you got to go back to. You can't go back to 1 second after you've left. I never like that rule. I don't like it in Bill and Ted, and that's one thing that always has irked me. But other than that, I don't really have too much of a problem with.
They also completely negated at the end of the bogus journey.
And that always kind of. I'm like, so they made that big rule and then they completely ignore it at the end of Bogus Journey, which is what it's. But yeah, so.
No, but it's interesting why they even put it in there. I presume because there isn't a big bad driving the story, you've got to have a we've got to be back by this time kind of thing driving the story, which is a little odd because, like you say, it's a time travel movie. So the whole tension of we have to be back at this time doesn't really make a lick of sense. But OK,
they needed the ticking clock, I assume. So they just manufactured one by making some arbitrary weird rule that I've never liked. And I thought it was kind of weird. But.
Sure. No, I mean, there's lots of stuff I like about the film and there's lots of stuff to be commended about the film. I mean, the fact that you have on the surface two idiotic characters who are going to be doing dumb slapsticky, you know, a catchphrasey things, but essentially you then have lots of almost high-minded comedy. Almost, they don't take the, you know, you've got a lot of high-minded characters that they go back to, you know, obviously you've got like Abe Lincoln and Socrates and Sigmund Freud and Beethoven and things like that. You've got a lot of characters who have some depth to them and some, a requirement of some intelligence or at least some knowledge to kind of be able to get some of the references. But then I feel like they squander that a little bit. You know, there's this idea that they all show up into the future and they're all just kind of okay with it. Like none of them are questioning it. And, you know, Beethoven is rocking out on the synthesizers and Joan of Arc is like doing workout and whatever. And like, that's absolutely fine. My favorite bit in it, and that they actually again spoil it by then sending him off to the water park, but the Napoleon character, the idea that in the bowling scene that Napoleon, this, you know, this arrogant, bombastic, you know, leader of men, warmonger, you know, this incredibly historical and important, you know, a general character who's incredibly highfalutin and arrogant is reduced to a laughing stock in a bowling alley. I think that there's something there, like there's something they are talking about, whether intentionally or not, about the idea that he's still just a short guy in a funny suit and a funny hat, and as much as he might do this or as much as he might do that in the past. You know, we can all be caught with our pants down kind of thing. It's not intrinsically there, but there's something there that I was watching it again. I was kind of enjoying that aspect of it. And I thought a lot more could have kind of been made of that. And I think it would have been, while I do love the report at the end of it, and while I also am aware that I'm talking very seriously about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, I feel that with the characters they brought into the future, especially someone like Abe Lincoln, I guess, especially something like Joan of Arc, even if you look at the difference between women when Joan of Arc was around and women the way they were, you know, celebrated in the 80s or looked at in the 80s, there could have been more. Once we'd got the time travel conceit, we didn't need to see them going to all the different times and picking them up. We could have just had Cut to the Future and then a longer time in San Dimas with more kind of jokes, but also a little bit of introspection about each of the characters and their
some commentary on the time. I see what you're saying, and I agree. I think there could have been something where they're coming to the present, or them coming to 89 or 88 or whatever it was at the time, that somehow, you know, it could have been for more of a reason than just doing a history report. Like, the history report, yeah, that's the big grand finale, but what else are they there for? What else are they there to learn or to teach us about? I mean, there certainly could have been done with that, but it wasn't that kind of movie.
And there's also the idea, right, of course, I mean, not to want to pick holes in time travel again, because obviously it's endless, but the idea that if Rufus can go back in time to change time in order to better the future, then any bringing these incredibly important famous people from the past to the present and then plumping them back in the past again is going to have massively drastic effects on the present being their future, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
meaning that if you take one example, if you take Napoleon out of the past, bring him to the present, he learns a bunch of stuff and then goes back to the past and, like he's saying in that end demonstration, build a big water slide through Russia or whatever he is, he's talking about that last bit. If he actually went back and tried to do that, the then present for Bill and Ted would be completely altered.
Well, that, and I mean, they take all these people, and how long do they have them? Like a couple days. I mean, if Napoleon's missing for a couple of days during the war, I mean, and then they send him back, I mean, you think that would change history a little bit? I mean, what if he lost earlier because of that? He was gone a couple of days. Maybe he missed something he was supposed to do, or I mean, because the clock, according to their rule, the clock's still ticking back where they were. So, however long he has these people, they're missing in their time.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so there is a big problem there. I mean, not that we should look too closely to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure for continuity, but yeah, there's some issue there as well that kind of, it does niggle your mind a little bit watching it as an adult.
I will say that, so like you, John, I watched it within the last year, but just for me, it was for the first time, but then I watched it again for this podcast. And I was kind of dreading watching it again for the podcast, I will admit. But the second viewing, I liked it a lot more. And I think having seen it, having gone through it, knowing what the movie was helped me better enjoy it the second time. I was expecting more of it the first time. I was expecting more of what you're talking about. And would that have been my personal preference? Probably, but... But knowing it wasn't there, it became more of a, okay, I can just sit back and enjoy Bill and Ted for who they are and watch the wacky antics.
Well, the interesting thing I found watching it again was that the vernacular did not grate. There's a lot of those movies I watch back, and like a lot of the John Hughes or the you know, those kind of things, where sometimes the vernacular or the 80s patois or whatever can really kind of grate. And you sort of think, shut up and talk normally. But with this, I think because Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves are genuinely like fucking great at these parts, like they're playing them really, really well, that actually their characters are endearing and are charming. And even with, you know, 2014 ears on, you can still watch them and kind of get involved in the movie. It never takes you out of the film.
Yes. Yes, I think, and I can't say much for Alex Winter, but Keanu is some of his best work in these two movies. Like, he emotes and actually does stuff more than he does since probably the next time I see him do it is like in The Gift, like in the 2000s is the next time I see him do any kind of big emoting like this.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Keanu should never have got serious. Clearly Keanu should just have done kind of comedies because he would have been a lot better. It's kind of like, although obviously Hanks is a much better actor, I wish Hanks had stayed on comedy because he was so much better at it than he is at being serious, I think. So, Pax, did you have any comments on the performances in the movie?
Yeah, like I said, I think especially Alex and Keanu, I thought they were really, really good, and they crushed it. I mean, I enjoyed them beginning to end. And like you said, their vernacular doesn't get old. I mean, I watched it for this podcast. I mean, I've seen this movie probably, you know, 10, 15 times since I saw it in the theater. And I watched it again for this podcast, and my wife and I were saying about, we were doing the air guitar thing, and we were, you know, like, and we were doing all that stuff after watching it. So, I mean, those guys are great. And obviously George Carlin is pretty good. If I liked anyone else, it was probably, I enjoyed, Ted's dad. I thought Ted's dad was funny.
Yeah, he's great.
And he gets to shine a bit in a scene in the next movie that that is one of my favorites, even including of all the stuff in here. I think it's one of the funniest. But both of the dads are pretty good. So
I love the scene in this one with the dad and Missy. Bill's dad and Missy in this one, where he shuts them out of his room as they go to the Circle K. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, that whole scene outside the Circle K, I like a lot. I think that's a good, strong scene. In fact, that's kind of some of my favorite parts of the movie, and probably the bit of the movie that feels a bit Back to the Future-ish in terms of its kind of style and design and vibe. I don't know why that is, but it does. It kind of has a Back to the Future kind of vibe, that bit. So
their Wild West was very Back to the Future Part 3.
Right.
They probably use the same sets.
I would imagine so, because, I mean, by sort of the end of the 80s, early 90s, there aren't many kind of streets like that left. In fact, I think the famous Warner Brothers one, Laramie Street, was last used for Briscoe County and then torn down. You've got old Tucson Studios, of course, still has a western town there because they get tourists there as well as using it for film shoots. But there aren't many left, actually. Just a brief chat then before we move on to the next movie. Sort of the idea then that this predates Wayne's World and predates Beavis and Butthead. Now, obviously, Beavis and Butthead have their kind of own thing going, and they're far more mischievous and generally thick. It's rather than charmingly so. But certainly on Wayne's World, there's a ton of stuff. I mean, the party on and the excellent, which I'm sure was in the vernacular, I guess, of American teens. But there seems to be a lot that kind of continues on to Wayne's World. Is that something you guys found, CT?
Yeah, I would say so. It was kind of a I don't know. It didn't stick out to me, but I mean, there was definitely that, like, yeah, it's two surfer dude kind of characters, them characters. I mean, there probably are even more examples at the time. I mean, I'm sure there are other things that we're not even thinking of, but this would seem to be one of the ones that predates that run of kind of setups and storytelling.
Yeah, because, I mean, Wayne's World, the first movie, comes out in 92, so a year after Bogus Journey, and obviously 3 years after this one.
But when was Wayne's World on SNL? It could have been
around
just
the same
after
time.
Well, I don't. Myers and Carvey would have been on late 80s, early 90s. I don't remember now when they started doing Wayne's World, but that it could have been as early as 1991.
That's what I was thinking, was about 1991.
So that would have predated Bogus Journey, or that could have been concurrent with Bogus Journey.
Right,
it would have been after Excellent.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering right.
What interested me the most was that obviously Excellent Adventure was a fairly big hit for the time, and Bogus Journey actually wasn't. I mean, it did make money. It was made for 20 mil and had a box office of 38 mil, but that's not, by Hollywood standards, a hit. That's a flop. Even though to the rest of us, 38 mil sounds like pretty good. But it's the idea that then Wayne's World comes out a year later, and then that's a big hit again. And I just find that interesting, considering the similarities, and considering that actually out of the four movies, the two Bill and Ted's and the two Wayne's World movies, for my personal taste, I find Bogus Journey the most inventive, interesting, and fun of the four of them. And so the idea that then doing the same kind of shtick, but then keeping it fairly rooted in reality in terms of Wayne's World and Wayne's World 2, rather than having time travel and all the other stuff, why that would then be a success again, whereas Bogus Journey wasn't. It's,
I don't know. Bogus Journey, and we're not on that movie yet, but I think that's probably too high concept for the masses. I mean, you see that. I think we talked about that with Back to the Future, even, where the second one comes along, and it's confusing to people who don't...
Well, that
don't,
and it... and it kind of deviated a bit. It tried something new and deviated a bit from the original formula, and I think that kind of lost people and, like you said, confused them.
But yeah. If it was too similar when we came to discussing it, we'd be saying right. it's another sequel retread.
Exactly. Exactly.
No,
right.
I agree. I'm glad they did it that way. But I think from the standpoint of the masses, or however you want to put it, people who aren't generally watching movies to think, it probably was confusing. Like, wait, they're not time traveling in this one? Wait, they're dead? Wait, I don't get what's going on. You know, that could have probably been the case to where
right.
that they shut it out.
So. Yeah. And there's some, like, the other thing I felt about Excellent Adventure is that there's some very good, you know, almost witty quip comedy. And I don't just mean their I don't just mean their catchphrases, but there's some actually good, like, asides and one-liners and ideas in sort of the first 30 minutes of the movie. But actually, the sort of the last two acts of Excellent Adventure become more of just a kind of romp with slapsticks and, oh, we have to go here and do this, then we have to go here and do this, then we have to go here and do this, then whatever. And what I liked about Bogus Journey, I think, is it brings back the idea of actual sort of intelligent one-liner observational and quote comedy throughout the movie. You know what I mean? I mean, most of it is on Sadler's shoulders, to be fair, but we can talk about that more in detail in a second. Most of the people playing the famous people are unknowns in this movie, as far as I'm aware, right?
I was actually going to comment on that there wasn't any stunt casting. There wasn't any, like, oh, here's Lincoln played by Jeremy Irons or whatever. Like, there wasn't, like, any kind of, oh, I know that guy when those people came through. So that, I think that actually helped, because then it let Lincoln be Lincoln. It let Sigmund Freud right. be Sigmund Freud. Like, I wasn't thinking of them as who they were as an actor or a star.
No, yeah. And I think that really does help the film. And I think it's also brave that they speak their own language and there isn't a whole bunch of, you know, trying to crowbar in Socrates suddenly being able to speak and understand English, or Joan of Arc being able to suddenly give eloquent speeches or things like that. I think it's brave and almost in an 80s high-concept American comedy to have all these ahistorical characters, but also, you know, foreign European other language speakers as well.
I feel like it's worth mentioning, I didn't bring it up earlier when you asked about favorite scenes, because it's at the end of the movie, but the whole idea of planting items after yeah. the adventure is over and that being the solution. When I first watched it, I hated it, but this time I watched it again for the podcast, for whatever reason, this time it clicked with me and I actually really liked it. I thought it was clever to then just start plotting out, like, okay, we need to do these five things after we're done, and oh, look, it's done. Like, here's the key. Oh, here's the tape recorder already going.
it's yeah. clever, but it doesn't make a lick of sense.
Because it's okay. It's okay though.
No, true. Yeah. It is okay, and I do enjoy it, and I like the fact they use it in both films. But yes. Obviously, how would they get through what they have to get through to do the exactly. first time round without being able to do those things? Do you know what I mean? Like, them going back afterwards and planting stuff there means that they have to have gone through it once, right? And if time is linear.
Exactly. And for something like this, I don't mind, but not to go off too much on a tangent, but Doctor yeah. Who has done this recently a lot. Stephen Moffat has written this kind of plot device into the shows, and it drives me nuts, because Doctor Who shouldn't cheat like this. Because it's not this kind of movie. It's not this kind of
right.
thing.
So it's not wacky and cartoony.
Yeah, exactly.
And they play off a little bit of that concept, like you were talking about, John, in the next movie, about only, like, they'd had to have been through it once to do it, and they had, because they have someone else do it, and then it's who, and they play a little bit with the idea that it's a little absurd in the next one.
Right. Yeah, well, exactly, because Joss Ackland's character, how would he have gone back and done something and anticipated what they'd done? I mean, unless it's an Edge of Tomorrow thing where they're on a constant loop and they have ultimate chances to figure this shit out. There's no real way that any of this would be possible. But the way I kind of watch these movies is this sort of like Warner Brother cartoon. Like when Warner Brother cartoons get a little weird and get a little esoteric and a little odd, I'm thinking of like the Barbershop of Seville type one, or the Duck and Muck one, and sort of when Warner Brothers cartoons kind of go off and start like playing with time and playing with character and playing with expectations, I feel like that's what these movies are doing. They're not meant to be realistic in that regard, you know what I mean? There's
right, yeah,
but I also feel there's enough, I think there's enough intelligence in them as well. It's weird to be saying that about these kind of dopey comedies, but I really feel like they're written with some intelligence to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't hold up if they were just sort of dumb, silly comedies. You know what I mean?
They are, and I think part of it is, I mean, yeah, it does have its dumb moments. Like, I love when Bill calls Ted's dad and says, "Deputy Van Halen," you know. And I mean, I love that. I think it's hilarious. But I think it's played with a wink that, I mean, it's in on the joke, and I think that helps. That it's played sort of earnestly, but it's also played that it knows that some of this is kind of absurd as well.
Yeah, no, I like the fact that when they're on the tape, when they can't think of what to say, they just go back to saying what they say when they're trying to make their music video.
Yes.
Yeah. The thing is once you've set up the characters, as long as you stay kind of true to those characters, the humor works. So in other words, the reason why that joke on the tape recorder works and is funny is because it is completely and utterly true to the character. Like everything they do is within the, you know, to use a long fancy word, but the verisimilitude of those characters and of the setting and of the plot and of the thing. It's not that, you know, the characters are not suddenly able to do a whole bunch of stuff that they weren't able to do 5 minutes ago. Do you know what I mean? It's all within keeping. Yes. And that's why the humor works, I think.
Yeah.
And that means the writing has to have some intelligence behind it, because you can't just... you can't just scribble this stuff off and go, oh, well, they're dumb teenagers, so we can have them say and do anything. There has to be some sort of continuation to it. And in fact, the way they build on, you know, the idea of bogus and bodacious and excellent, and these sort of these words that end up becoming kind of long and odd when, you know, Bill starts having these other words. I can't think off the top of my head some of them. What does he say about heaven? It was most, did he say tranquilizing or something? I forget what it is. Or maybe he's talking about Greece or something. But there's, that is another thread that they constantly come back to. And like you say, is a little bit knowing about it and start coming up with more interesting little bon mots and words and things that he can use that I find charming about it, that keep it going, I think. So, Pax, then, any final thoughts on Excellent Adventure before we move on?
Just that, I mean, I love the movie, and I know a lot of it is nostalgia, but, I mean, it still holds up for me. My wife and I still have, just before we got on, we were doing the air guitar thing. So, I mean, it still holds up, and I still really, really enjoy it.
And CT?
I think... It takes going into it with the right mindset, the right mentality, especially if you've not ever seen it before. I can definitely see where if you've got the same nostalgia, if you'd seen this back in '89, that's the ideal time probably to have seen it and to have grown up with it. But that aside, if you're watching it now for the first time, I think you've got to go into it with the right mindset and maybe give it a second chance, even like I did, and it's worth it. So. I'm glad to have watched it. And I will just throw in one other little sidebar. Came to mind another duo that predates these guys, but I always associated Wayne's World with the Bob and Doug McKenzie from SCTV.
Sure.
So it's just another sort of duo. It's like these two dumb guys. It's not the surfer, like, excellent kind of guys, but it's two dumb guys who get into adventures. And
they have their own vernacular.
Have their own vernacular. I'd say Strange Brew is sort of a precursor to this as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a really good point to make, I don't think people would forgive me if I didn't mention Al Leong as Genghis Khan. That's inspired casting. I think that's incredible that you have Al Leong, and obviously you get to see him doing some of his weapon stuff. And also, did you guys notice that in the first one and the second one, they have teachers being played by famous character actors from the blaxploitation era? In the first one, you have Bernie Casey, And in the second one, you have Pam Grier.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Good call.
Which is odd, right? I mean, where's that coming from? I mean, it's fantastic. I love it when you see them cropping up in work, because obviously it had been, you know, over 10 years since their last kind of big hurrah in terms of leading actor status in movies. But yeah, just odd that they would. I don't know. I want to kind of talk to someone involved in the movie and see if that was even intentional or whether. You know, where they put Bernie Casey in the first one, which isn't unusual because he was doing kind of work like this, and whether they went, oh, okay, so who can we have for the second one? Oh, we need this female character. We could always get Pam Grier. I wonder if that was even a thought or whether it just happened to be like that. I like to think it's a key moment. But I love the fact that people like Al Leong and Bernie Casey are in this movie. That just kind of adds to it. For me, personally, from my movie taste and my action love and all the rest of it. So but yes, okay, great film, enjoyed that immensely. So let's move on to what I personally think is the better film, me personally, and that is Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey from 1991. So 2 years later they come out with this movie, so they're more or less in terms of movie making time back to back. This time it's directed by Peter Hewitt, who has done nothing else that even comes close to being this good, doing as he has done. I mean, I suppose The Borrowers was all right, just maybe. But apart from that, he's done a sort of English comedy that failed to ignite called Whatever Happened to Harold Smith that nobody saw. He did Garfield. Wow, glad he gave us that. Zoom, which I've never heard of. And Home Alone, The Holiday Heist, which was a TV movie. They were still pumping out Home Alones in 2012. Who the fuck knew?
Did you say Zoom? Is that the one with Tim Allen?
Yes.
The superhero movie?
Okay. Yes.
I've seen that. I've actually watched that.
You mean that's a kind of a Sky High thing, right? Only Sky High is much better.
Very, very similar. Yeah, and Sky High is much better. I didn't think it was too bad.
No Kurt Russell,
but it was not. Yeah, it wasn't Sky High.
Tim Allen, Kurt Russell.
I mean, no problem with Tim Allen, but he's not Kurt Russell.
He's not Kurt Russell, and he's not Bruce Campbell, who's also in Sky High. So is it written by the same guys as well? Yes, Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon do write this one as well. So it's written by the same guys, directed by a different guy, and obviously adds William Sadler to the mix. A previous Diner guest, I get to say, William Sadler.
Great episode, by the way, John.
Thank you very much.
Good show.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we'll have the trailer now.
About to embark upon a most unprecedented expedition.
Once they made history.
I must see to it that you die.
Now, they are history. Bill and Ted are dead.
Welcome to hell.
It's the Grim Reaper, dude. How's it hanging, Death?
But they're having one hell of a time.
This is not what I expected this place to look like at all.
We got totally lied to by our album covers, man.
Taking in the sights.
Not bad, dude. We totally knew a guy got one of those in his bucket of chicken.
Making new friends.
Excuse us, dude, but is there any way we can get back?
You may challenge me to a contest.
J7.
You have sank my battleship.
Excellent!
Best 2 out of 3.
What?
Enjoying the family.
No way!
Invading the present.
I totally possess my dad.
Battling the future.
You metal, dude! Excuse us, but your shoes are untied. Just melting death!
And meeting their maker.
Guy, congratulations on Earth! Not to mention your other great planets. Mars, Jupiter, Uranus.
It's the comeback of all time. Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. It's a trip.
Best of 7?
Damn right!
Ah, dude!
Left hand red.
Ted's Bogus Journey.
And All right, so let's go in with CT first, and let's talk about Bogus Journey. Just an overview, and your was this another first time watch for you?
Yes, it was. So after I'd seen Excellent Adventure earlier in the year for the first time, I had no desire to continue. At the time, I just didn't really seem like something I wanted to bother with. Sequels generally aren't as good. You know, that's the general track record. So I had no idea that when I would watch it for this podcast, that it would turn out to be my favorite of the movies. In fact, I'm completely with you, John. I think this is the stronger film. I think you need to have seen Excellent Adventure for this to really work.
Yes, but, completely. Yes.
So you have to. I think you have to have had the backstory in the first one. You have to know the characters. You have to have really gotten that sense of what the world is, because they don't. They do set it up again, but they don't really go into it much depth. And so I think now that you've got that out of the way, this is a great second adventure, and they go from there. I like that there is a threat, and like I was saying before, it's much more high concept. There's you know, they die. I mean, that's kind of shocking, actually. They kill off the characters, and then they have to travel to hell and then heaven and get back. And
yeah, with no ceremony either. It's not like a big mawkish death where everyone mourns their death. They're just like thrown off Vasquez rocks, and then immediately you're into even more comedy about the fact that they're dead, you know?
Right, yeah. Right. So I enjoyed this a lot better. And I felt like that Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter came back and were even stronger in this.
They
Their performances
are even
better than, yeah. than this. And they even do, because of the evil counterparts, they get to really expand their chops and do the evil versions of themselves, which aren't that different.
Right.
But just different enough to where you know that they're different characters. So I was impressed.
Well, the nice thing I like about it is that, and this is the mark of a good performance or good acting, whatever you want to call it, is that you are at no point watching Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves. You are watching Bill and Ted. Completely and utterly, I buy Bill and Ted. I'm not watching actors play a role. I'm watching two characters in a continuation of their adventures. And I'm completely, by the time I put in the second movie, I'm completely ready to just keep going. And I think you are completely right, CT. I think you have to have seen Excellent Adventure. And I don't think Excellent Adventure is a terrible movie. I think Excellent Adventure is a perfectly good movie. I think this betters it in terms of invention and creation and style and comedy and direction and just a whole bunch of other things, and having a through line and having a villain and so on. But I do agree, they do work very strongly as a double act in as movies. And so, yeah, let's hear from Pax then. So you're feeling, Pax, on Bogus Journey. And obviously you were a big advocate for the first one. So let's see what you think about this one.
Yeah, I love the first one. So I went and saw the second one in the theater. And for years I was a little disappointed with the second one. I thought Bill and Ted were great. And there were sequences in this movie I love. And I think there are a couple in particular that I think are even better than some of the stuff that's in the first one. But beginning to end, I was disappointed with the movie, and that continued for years. Now, in the last 5 years, I've kind of started coming around to this movie, and I appreciate what they were trying to do and that they were trying to do something different. And I've come along a little bit more on it with the other stuff besides the couple things that I did love. So I'm starting to come around a little bit more on it.
See, to me, it kind of fits in almost like Gremlins 2 in terms of as a big studio sequel. And, you know, $20 million was quite a bit of money in 91 to throw at a sequel to what was probably more of a low-budget affair in Excellent Adventure. It was interesting to me to see for my taste, the combination of a sort of Gilliam-esque and almost Tim Burton-esque at times artistic kind of viewpoint to a lot of the material. I'm thinking especially about the hell sequences and the death, the fact that the whole death sequence when they're doing the challenges and the games and things, the ice, you have sunk my battleship, that sequence. yeah. That whole bit is it's filmed how Gilliam would film comedy. In other words, Gilliam doesn't film comedy with big bright lights and dum-da-da, here's comedy. He films it with, like, shadow and eerie shit going on and madness and whatever it is. I think that William Sadler only elevates this movie. I can't tell you how unabashedly joyful I was when this movie ended. Like, it completely picks me up at the beginning of the film, makes me howl with laughter all the way through, makes me marvel at the invention not only of the storytelling but also of the direction and the set pieces and the art design and the sequence with the granny that obviously Alex Winter is also playing, trying to kiss the little boy in hell. The way that is done is... I mean, it's genuinely unnerving. I mean, I remember being an 11-year-old boy, like watching this in the cinema, and vividly remember it. And obviously, I think I've said many times before that I was kind of squeamish. Considering my love of horror now, I was not a kid who was into horror, but I did love Gilliam stuff. Like, I did eat up Time Bandits and Brazil and movies like that. Like, I was and 12 Monkeys later on when it came out and things. I was a big fan of that kind of stuff. And I was a big fan of Python and obviously Holy Grail and Life of Brian. They're filmed very naturalistically, even in their weirder and wilder moments. So, but seeing something like this in the cinema when I was 11, what it does for me is, yes, it was kind of nervous and nerve-wracking because there's this weird spooky stuff going on, but I'm also sat there as a kid, like, marveling at the way it looks and marveling at the color palette and marveling at the makeup and marveling at the thing. And I'm sat here watching it as a 34-year-old, having not seen it 100 times but having seen it probably about a handful of times, and I'm still marveling at all those things. That, like, that's how I think that's why my love of this movie still holds up, is because I really do feel that it is... It takes the concept of here are these guys and they're going to go on an adventure to maintain the future being what the future is that they created, this kind of be excellent to one another kind of utopia.
To me, it finally sells me on them, actually. You look at, like, the whole gag is, like, here are these two dumb guys and the whole society 100, you know, or 500 years from now is built on them. And I had a hard time buying into that. But after watching Bogus Journey and seeing how they overcome that challenge, seeing how they die and come back to life, and then that raises to me them, in my mind, their character and who they are as people, then I can buy into, yeah, there's something to be said for a society built on these guys, as absurd as it sounds. These guys palled around with death and made friends with a Martian who had died and bring this Martian back from the dead and build robot duplicates of themselves to save the world. Like, these guys did that. So, yeah, society can be built off them, and I completely buy into that now.
It's also the fact, I mean, as much as you can't watch this one without having seen Excellent Adventure, you almost can't watch Excellent Adventure and not watch this one. It's a complete continuation of the story. And in fact, to make a third one, now that I've seen these two again back-to-back recently, seems completely redundant. Because, I mean, unless, what, the future's in peril again? Like, you know what I mean? Or we're now living in that future, but we're not living in that future in reality. So where is this now going to be set? Like, I don't want them to mess with this. I love the idea that at the end of this movie, because of something that the villain tried to do, a... yes, kind of slightly sentimental, but also something that I do feel in my bones, this idea of music as the great uniter and music as the great kind of powerful force of love in the world. Because you can say I love you to a million people, but playing a love song to a million people has a whole other reaction. Do you know what I mean? It's so unifying in that regard. And I genuinely buy the ending of this. Like, I get a lump in my throat. I hate that, you know, it's like the end of a dumb comedy movie. But at the end of at the same time, I'm so glad they win. You know what I mean? I'm so glad that it's like God gave rock and roll to us and this big, like, rock ballad anthem. I love the fact that in a very simple way, they say at the end of the movie, they don't have some big character arc, they don't learn a ton of truths. The one thing they learn, which I think is incredible that a comedy even has this message, is we've been to the past, we've been to the future, and we've been all through the afterlife. And what we've learned is, through all this, is not some big great thing. It's that we want to be here right in time, and we want to be here in space. And that's like a huge, like, awesome fucking message to drill into people. Because a lot of people wander around all the time with, oh, I should have been born in the 50s or 60s or 70s, or life was better when. And I think what we should be learning to do is living in the now. Your thoughts, CT?
Yes. No, I agree with what you're saying. And in fact, I was just watching, it's another time travel movie. I just was watching About Time, which is written and directed by Richard Curtis. And it's got a very similar theme. And it's got some comedy elements, but it's very much more dramatic and romantic and everything. But it's very much similar in its message. And it's like, live your moments and enjoy the moments now, because that's what you've got. Like, we're always all traveling through time. And you need to realize that and not, like, dwell in the past or think about the future. I mean, there's some element you need to do that. But enjoy the moments we have now. And that isn't, like, hammered on your head and, like, really, you know, like, you're not rolled over with a steamroller with that being the message in Bogus Journey. But it is sort of that message, like you're saying. And it's good to see that come through. And I think it addresses the sort of the differences between this movie and the other movie, where I don't know if I saw that kind of theme come out of the first one, but it starts certainly, and then it resolves in this one. So I agree.
And I think that it gets its big Hollywood ending in terms of, here is your big, like, your heroes have won, and here is your big kind of sentimental finale. Without it, you know, I can be cynical and British and full of irony at the best of times. And very often, if you have a big soppy ending to a movie, that I feel either hasn't earned it or is just being Hollywood for the sake of being Hollywood, I go, oh, I've been gobbed on by fucking Hollywood. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I need to go and have a shower. But this movie ends, and I only feel unabashed joy, and I think that's a great achievement. So, Pax, your feelings towards, like, some of the things we've been talking about, like the mess of the movie and the feeling at the end of the film, or anything. Are you getting that now, having kind of learned to re-love this film or not?
Yeah, a little bit. I the ending used to bother me a lot because they ignored the rule from the first one, so I used to just kind of dismiss it. But the last few times I watched it, I got what you were saying about. I listened to what Bill said at the end, and then was saying, like, we want to be here, and we've traveled all over the place, and this is where we want to be. And I thought that, wow, that is a pretty good message. And I like that, you know, Death joined the band, and that he had his little rap there, and like the end is joyful and fun, and the last time I watched it, I really enjoyed it. Some of the other stuff, like, I don't know, the tone was different. Like, I think a lot of it is remnants of the problems I had when I watched it in the theater, the change in tone. I don't really like the evil robots. I think they're too much. It's like the tone is dark, but then they crank up the goofiness, and for me that's a difference in tone that I always have had a problem with. But the last few times I've watched it, it's bothered me less and less. And
I mean, the head dunking scene, and sort of, you are right in terms of, although it does have a big villain, which is a good thing, we spend little to no time with them. And when we do spend time with them, they're kind of redundant scenes where they're just kind of dunking each other's head or driving around trying to hit pussycats or whatever it is. Yeah. No, yeah, I can totally agree with you on that one.
Yeah, and so that's just some of the stuff that's always been kind of there for me. And it's kind of falling away a little bit as I find things in there that I'm sticking to. And like the ending is one of them. And You guys have mentioned it. Sadler, everything Sadler does in this movie is top shelf. It's great. He is fantastic in this movie. The best out of seven. Damn right. And yeah, all love of that. That. It's fantastic. And he, even when I watched it in the theater, was the best thing about this movie. And I loved every bit of it.
Yeah, I mean, Sadler's performance, that it's in a movie called Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, it kind of doesn't give it the fucking award-worthy pomp and circumstance it really deserves. I mean, it is up there for me, and this is no exaggeration, with any finely tuned comic performance. I mean, it's up there with Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau, or, you know, Leslie Nielsen as Frank Drebin, or whatever it is. Like, I've picked two very similar things. But what I mean is it's up there with any of those kind of finely tuned comedic performances. I mean, it's just incredible, the fact that, and I know that a lot of it was probably on the hoof, especially when he walks back in with God, where you see that whole scene where they talk to God and you're like, okay, fine, they've talked to God, and they wander off. And then Sadler just wanders back on and goes, I'm terribly sorry they Melvin'd me. And it's incredible, just his timing and the way he, and when, not only that, but the fact that he decides to play death eventually as this kind of petty-minded, please pay attention to me type thing, which isn't in the script, it's kind of something Sadler's bringing to it, is incredible. Like when he dresses up as the woman, which is utterly ridiculous, and then yes. They go, oh yeah, Death, you look really good, and he's like, do I? Do you think it works? Like it's so good. It's incredible. Yeah.
I seem to recall you in your interview with him talking about this movie, and didn't he have a story about the line to the guy who was smoking in the store being an ad lib?
Yes, completely. Yes, it was something he came up with. Yeah,
I just think it's interesting that he is not. I don't think of him as a comedic actor. Like, think of all of his famous roles, you know, like Die Hard 2 and Tales from the Crypt, and I mean, there's tons I'm not even thinking about, and he's. This is really the only thing comedic that comes to mind. I'm sure there's others, but
Second Tales from the Crypt movie, he has a brief cameo as a mummy talking to the Crypt Keeper at the beginning, and yes. He's very funny in that, but it's really only a cameo.
It's almost a missed opportunity that he doesn't have more comedic roles in his on his IMDb list. There's something that to be said for what he can do as a comedian.
His timing is impeccable. His timing, the way that he mangles the accent around his mouth, the fact that he decided, obviously the look of it is from The Seventh Seal. The yes. fact that there is sort of that cinematic reference and cinematic pedigree and Sadler looking at the look of himself and going, oh, okay, well, I'll play it as a Nordic character then. I mean, if that's where I'm coming from, I will play it as this sort of Northern European, slightly Swedish, slightly German kind of character. And there's this whole thing tied into that, which is kind of then becomes brilliantly comic. I mean, I think with both films, there are layers to it that are far beyond just a couple of dopey California kids go on an adventure. I think there's lots more layers to it. And I think the Bogus Journey having the layers of cinematic reference and comedic reference and all that is a joy to someone like myself who is such a fan of cinema in general, you know.
Yeah.
And what about the Hell sequence? I mean, it is Tim Burton-esque, isn't it? The way they've got like the bright primary colors, but all the Dutch built-in Dutch angles and stuff. It's sort of quite reminiscent of Purgatory and Beetlejuice.
Oh yeah, good. Good point. I'll say that that when I was watching it, I was thinking, wow, you know, like there's really like this would not be a place I'd want to ever end up. You know, they're really painting a dark, horrific picture of hell. And at the very beginning, you know, they show up and they're like, oh, hey, who's that? And they're like doing the devil horn, you know, all the different stuff. And then like once they get into they drop down and they're into that, the different halls and the different rooms and stuff. It's like, that's insanely creepy and insanely dark and not what I was expecting from this kind of movie, but it was very well done.
And the nice thing about the two movies in terms of tone, although the second one, I mean, as kids, we would have maybe found darker. But, I mean, as an adult, it's like it's not dark in that respect. In terms of visuals, it's fine. But the tone being maintained that it's basically a kind of cartoon venture. You know what I mean? Mm. There's no, and they walk a fine line very well in this idea of, well, the characters can be scared and the characters can get upset. I mean, think about the scene, of course, in the first one where Bill thinks Ted has been killed. So the characters can have emotions, but we can't push it to the point of people genuinely being... we can't watch the movie and be like, oh my God, they're really afraid, or oh my God, they're really upset. But at the same time, we can't watch the movie and go, none of this really matters. They're just kind of Tex Avery, Warner Brothers style characters. They do walk a very fine line, and I think they do a very good job of it, both Winters and Reeves. Do you guys agree, Pax?
I do. Yes, I do agree. They walk that fine line, and some of that, like I said, was some of the stuff that I've had to come around to. But I mean, they do. They step it up in this one, and they do walk that line, and they do just kind of do the separate things. And they were able to stretch a little bit. And like I said, it's one of those things that's just they're doing something different and something different from the first one. And I do now see that they're doing a really good job on it.
And are there any are there any particular scenes now that kind of stand out for you? What do you think of like Station and that whole new character?
I didn't love Station, and I still don't love Station. I do like when he's building the robot. I think that's a pretty cool scene.
Right.
I mentioned I love the Sadler Games ones, but one of the ones when I watched it this time that I literally laughed out loud and actually had to watch it again was when Bill and Ted go back to the police station and Ted possesses his dad.
Sure.
And his dad fucking nails Ted. I mean, he nails it. It makes me wonder if like Keanu did the scene as Ted and then his dad did it after watching him do it, because he just
Hal Landon Jr. is the actor. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he nails it, and then he does that, and it's just I was crying laughing at
that's
it because it was
a phenomenal
just so
joke. The jazz guitar joke is incredible.
Yes. And it was great.
As is the Missy swap. I love the idea that Missy yes. is now married to his dad.
Yes.
Which is a good idea.
Well, I agree that with Pax. That might have been the best scene in the movie. That or the games with death. But the two actors did a pretty good job, but Ted's dad was the best. And it was interesting too, going back to Ted's dad and that whole dynamic was just almost the throwaway of Bill's stepmom had divorced Bill's dad and was now married to Ted's dad, and it was in there for almost no reason, just other than the joke of showing Bill's sad dad.
Right, exactly. And it's sort of like that actor just showed up for that scene just to be his sad dad. He's not in any of the other movie, like the rest of the movie, it's except that one party scene. It's almost a Wayne's World joke. There's a lot of jokes like that about sort of in Wayne's World, I feel, and it's almost one of those jokes in the movie versions, I mean. No, I do love it. I think it's, again, it's one of those things that two writers have sat up. These writers are clearly like mates with each other. They've sat up. They've come up with a funny idea. Not only that, but Missy, although she's like painted as this kind of slut, she, you know, she's been with there's indication she's been with Bernie Casey as well as being with these other older guys or whatever. At the same time, she's also a character like you don't hate her. She's not like, she's not like a big-chested, ditzy idiot. You know what I mean? Like she's someone that the girls hang out with, and you know that she seems like a reasonably okay person, except the fact that she's going off with all these older men and destroying older men's lives. But I mean, apart from that, I kind of like her as a character, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do
I don't hate her, is what I mean. No, my other point that I was going to make earlier is as much as Hal Landon Jr. is incredible at doing an older Ted, and he is, I thought the kids did a really good job. I mean, they only get the one scene, but I think did a really good job of being young Bill and Ted, I think, in the hell sequence.
In the hell sequence.
Yeah, I think they did really well. Anyway, I really enjoyed that. So Last final thoughts then on Bogus Journey. I mean, I'm happy to end it by saying, you know what, for me personally, I think you need to watch both of them. I prefer the look, style, comedy and everything I've been talking about in Bogus Journey. I would also urge people that if they watch Bogus Journey once, if they've never seen it before, watch it immediately again and just watch everything Sadler is doing in the background. There's this amazing bit in the store where Bill is on the phone in the foreground, and in the background, Sadler is looking through some building instructions or something in a pamphlet and trying to like measure out and imagine what the cabinet or whatever it is he's looking at would be like. And it's just hilarious. Everything he is doing, from facial expression to body language, is just incredible. And if they're, you know, and again, it's a completely thankless task because no one apart from us guys will ever give a shit. But incredible what he's doing. So, but no, I think they definitely work as a pair. You can't watch one without the other, and I think that's quite nice. I think that's quite good. So, Pax, if you want to go with your final thoughts.
Yeah, like I said, the second one for me has been one that I've had to come around on. But there's definitely, I mean, even if you find the change in tone jarring, there is stuff in Bogus Journey to love. It doesn't get enough credit for being something that takes the original concept, tries something a little different, and for the most part succeeds. Watching Sadler as the Grim Reaper, watching Bill and Ted themselves still be themselves but also try to do something different, and that one possession scene, which I'm still laughing at. It's a good movie, and it's much better than I even gave it credit for. And I agree. You got to watch the pair because it's definitely a complete continuation of it.
CT?
Well, I'm not going to say anything too drastically different. I would agree that it's well worth watching. I would not have predicted that going into the Bogus Journey this time, because it was just having watched Excellent Adventure once before, I was not expecting to be as pleased and as satisfied with this one as I was, and so that's a good thing. And I agree with both of what you're saying. It's just 90 minutes each, so you're looking at a 3-hour time commitment for these two movies. You could do that in an evening, and it's a good sit down. Pretty much family fun, I'd say, too. I think it's something that, for the most part, you could watch with your kids. They'd probably get it, too. So,
yeah, and I think there's a lot more going on in both movies than is on the surface, which is something that I take away from it and enjoy. Because, as I said, you know, my formative years is Monty Python. And like them or hate them, there's a lot more going on in Monty Python than meets the eye. But there's also a lot of just plain unabashed silliness that's going on in Monty Python as well. So like these seem to be good things. Obviously, I just want to give a shout out again to Pam Grier. The fact that in this movie Sadler I've interviewed and turned out to be one of the nicest guys I've ever spoken to, and continues to be. He occasionally, funny William Sadler story just to end the show. Recently, I forget what it was we were talking about in our Facebook group, the After Movie Diner and Doctor Action Facebook group, which everyone should go over and join immediately. Just look up groups and look up Doctor Action or After Movie Diner and you'll find us there.
I joined.
Yes, you should join. It's good fun. We have some great conversations over there. But we were talking about something recently about Sadler. I think maybe Die Hard 2 or whatever. No, this was it. I'm going to tell the story properly. Someone was talking about the Denzel Washington trailer for the new Equalizer movie. And someone had posted it and was talking about that in the group. And all of a sudden, because he does this sometimes, because he's friends with me on Facebook, Sadler popped up and said something along the lines of, oh, yeah, I remember working on the original TV show with Edward Woodward, is what he said, right? To which the person who'd been commenting above suddenly realized that William fucking Sadler had commented on one of his things, and he literally wrote, Jesus fuck, William Sadler, like ! exclamation mark, as if you could immediately like see his thought processes. So I thought that was absolutely charming. And Sadler is also, if I haven't told you guys, when I interviewed him, it was in the afternoon, and I think we finished around maybe 3:30, something like that. Anyway, I set to work editing the show and going about my day and blah, 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 blah. When I came back to Twitter, which is where we initially got communicating, I had a direct message, and I checked what that direct message was, and it was William Sadler again at about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So it was some hours after we'd finished recording. I'd already said my thank yous to him, and he'd said his thank yous to me, and, you know, we'd parted ways well. And he wrote another direct message at several hours later to say, thanks again, John. I was thinking back, and I really enjoyed that interview. Thanks so much for chatting with me, and take care. Like, all the best, Bill. And I thought to myself, that's real class. Like, we've done our bit, we've done our interview, we've done our thing, we've ended very, you know, friendly and congenially, no problem at all. To then be sat around and thinking, I did enjoy that, I should tell him again. Do you know what I mean? That's a
class act.
That's
sure.
A real class act. So I really like that. It's a good Sadler thing. And of course, last but not least, Pam Grier is in this movie looking foxy as always. Wouldn't it be amazing if George Carlin lived inside Pam Grier? That would just be a dream come true. You'd have one of the best.
That's where he is.
Yeah, one of the best stand-ups in the world. One of the best stand-ups in the world ever, and one of the sexiest women in the world ever. That would kind of be my perfect woman, but.
That does remind me. I do wish there was more George Carlin, and not just because of his name, but I do wish there was more of him in the second one, because he shows up at the beginning, and then I kept expecting him to pop up somewhere, and it doesn't happen until the very end.
Yeah, I mean, he's not in the first one as much as I remember him being either. So, and I don't know if it was just a favor he did, or whether he just cropped up for a couple of days shoot here and there. You know, Joss Ackland is another one. He plays the big bad in the second movie. He's in it for about 5 minutes at the beginning and about 5 minutes at the end, you know, a couple of scenes in the middle maybe. But, yeah, I do miss Rufus, but I think I missed Rufus before I suddenly realized watching the first one that, oh, yeah, my memory had put him in these movies more than he is in general. Yeah. I always think of them traveling through time in the first one with Rufus, and of course he doesn't do that. Sadler, I suppose, kind of takes his place in this second one, but is far more an integrated companion than Rufus ever is in either of the two movies. But I know what you mean. Yes, I do miss George in the films. But you know, he does his little bit at the beginning and end of this film, which is absolutely fine. But yes, Pam Grier. Always got to love Pam Grier. Any movie with Pam Grier in is worth being on the list. So, all right, guys. So that's that for those two movies. And we talked a lot about what you were doing earlier on in the episode. But if you want to re-pimp any of your stuff, let's do that now. Let's take that opportunity now.
Pax, why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, you can find me with CT on the Nerd Lunch podcast every week. And I do a monthly podcast, Cult Film Club, over on cultfilmclub.com, and you can check me out on my blog. I have a pop culture humor blog called cavalcadeofawesome.net.
Yep, and you can find, as the aforementioned Nerd Lunch podcast, on iTunes and Stitcher and all the places that podcasts hang out together. And if you don't want to do that, you can find us at nerdlunch.net. And then you can find James Pod also on iTunes and Stitcher. And we have a website. It's podjamespod.tumblr. That's without that. Oh, you know, that's a Tumblr site.com. And I'm hanging out as Nerd Lunch and all the Twitter and Facebooks and all that stuff.
Well, thanks ever so much for joining us, guys. I've had a ball. We'll have you back on definitely for free, Jack, and something else I can find.
But you're not going to invite Ajeej, right? Again, because we don't want him a part of this, right?
Ajeej wasn't part of the Back to the Future either, was he?
No.
So I think us three works fine. We don't need Ajeej. I mean, what is Ajeej really? At the end of the day, his name sounds like something that a window washer's apparatus makes a sound like on the window, kind of thing. Ajeej.
That's where he got it.
Yeah, okay. That was a long, convoluted way around. But no, honestly, thanks ever so much, guys, for being on the show. A lot of good times. And, yeah, please do come back soon. And everyone, check out Nerd Lunch. It's a great show. Good times.
It's a little bit funny, the feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did. I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no. Or a man who makes potions in a traveling show with his beard. I know it's not much,
but it's the best
I can do. My gift is my song, and this one for you.
And you can tell everybody.
This is your song.
It may be quite simple, but
now that it's done, I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words, how wonderful life is. Now you're in the world.
Like the show? Well, you can find our complete podcast archive over at amdpodcast.blogspot.com or aftermoviediner.com. You can send us an email at aftermoviediner@gmail.com, tweet us at aftermoviediner, or follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/aftermoviediner. Or why not be a part of the show and leave us a voicemail over at speakpipe.com/aftermoviediner. You can also support the show a number of ways, by spreading the word to family, friends and co-workers, by writing us a review over at iTunes or TalkShoe, by purchasing some excellent diner merchandise over at cafepress.com/aftermoviediner, by donating on our website, by advertising with our website, or maybe you're a regular Amazon user. If so, then before you make a purchase, go to amdpodcast.blogspot.com, aftermoviediner.blogspot.com, or aftermoviediner.com, and click through the Amazon banner ads. It costs you nothing extra, but they throw us a few coins for the trouble. Or, like the movies we cover, then buy them over at our personal Amazon store, also on amdpodcast.blogspot.com. Really, thanks everybody for everything you continue to do, and please keep listening.
There are men, and then there are second unit podcast men. The podcast you've just been listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include Drunk on VHS, We Came from the Basement, No Budget Nightmares, The Aftermovie Diner, Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid, and Bloodbaths and Boomsticks. Take one podcast into the shower. Don't be a blithering idiot, Alan. We can give you the multiple podcast cleansing system all in one place your hair deserves. Our programming is available across all platforms, from iTunes to Podomatic, TalkShoe to Stitcher, so you have absolutely no excuse. Listen today, and a free naked person of your choice will be shipped from Thailand to your door in a matter of weeks. The Second Unit Podcast Network, bringing you the action and leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Bloody hell, who does a girl have to blow around here to get a decent beverage?